So it's not really possible to cover the whole mother economy in 2 1-hour classes. So what I'm going to be doing is this morning giving an overview, and then this evening at 5:15, then I'll be just going over basically Anista and Nista Sadhana Bhakti and an overview this morning. And this is not going to be just lecture format, which is why you're all supposed to have something to write on and something to write with. If you have nothing else, you can write on your arm, I suppose, with your blood or something. No, just kidding. So he says something to write on, something to write with, and all of you, I hope, got the handout. This chart that you were given, this was done by myself, a devotee named Murli Dharpuru, and also by Dear Krishna Swami. So it was sort of it's worked on over a period of years and gradually added to. Then tomorrow morning, I'm going to be giving a class on a verse from Third Canto Bhagavatam that's a synopsis of a 5-day, 1-hour a day, 1.5-hour a day, 2 hours, I don't know how long, pretty long, seminar that Bhakti Vigyan Swami gave in Radhadesh last summer on liberation through sound. So it's going to be the synopsis of his main points. And it's because it's not my class, I can say that it's one of the best classes that I know of, and I think you'll really enjoy it. There's a handout for that too, and I would suggest all of you, after the class tomorrow morning, that you listen to the entire seminar series by Bhakti Vigyan Swami, which is available at iskcon.com on the audio section. So that will be tomorrow. And although the point of view of today's classes and tomorrow's class is going to be a little different, the subject matter is really the same. It's basically how does one make advancement through the process of Krishna consciousness. The lens is going to be somewhat different. And I should say that we can explain this process of how we make advancement through a number of different lenses. You can talk about the yoga ladder, that there's karma yoga, there's niskam karma yoga, there's gyan yoga, there's jnana yoga, and then there's bhakti yoga. You can talk about levels of faith. You can talk about the Kanista Adhikari, the Madhyama Adhikari, the Uttama Adhikari. You can talk, as we will do tomorrow morning, about levels of sound. And today we're going to be talking about the levels described by Rupa Goswami, and in this case by also by Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur. And Srila Prabhupada speaks about, either directly or indirectly, this process of advancement all throughout his books and his lectures, as sometimes according to this particular format and sometimes according to the other format. And it's very helpful when you have a plan. Just like most of us in this room don't live here. So we had to have a plan for how to get here. And for me, for example, I had to take 3 airplanes. Well, it's not so bad. Last time I went to India, I had to take 5 airplanes. So, you know, there's different stages, and you can see, and I don't know if you have this on the inter-Europe flights, but on the, at least the intercontinental flights, they now have, on all the airlines, I think, a little map where you can see where the plane is. Have any of you seen that? You can see at every moment where the plane is, and it says, you know, you've already flown so many kilometers, and then you have so many kilometers left to go. This is your estimated arrival time. This is your local time. This is your time at your destination. So the Madhurya Kadambini is very much like that. It says, this is your local time. This is where you're at now. This is your time at your destination. And these are the steps to go there. This is how many kilometers you've already gone and how many kilometers you have to go. So it's quite useful and helpful information. This is where you have to turn right. This is where you have to turn left. This is where, be careful you don't take the wrong road. Don't loop around backwards here. When Prabhupada talks about this as being a scientific process, that refers to many things, but one of them is to this sort of understanding. And we find that although many religions in the world are teaching some degree of a genuine process, they very rarely can give people step-by-step guidance as to how they're going to achieve it. It's kind of a very vague thing. Well, just, you know, be a good person or love God or something. But you don't really know how to do it or how to judge your own progress. Okay? Does that sound like a worthwhile thing to spend an hour of our life this morning doing? Sounds okay? Mount Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasad Vikramashi Marthi Vati Vati Swami Kinamani Namaste Saraswati Devi Govara Patani Vishnu Sinai Puja Vesatani Vandeham Shri Guru Shri Ta Parakamalam Shri Guru Vaishnavam Cha Shri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagana Raghunatham Bhutam Stam Sajivam Sadvaitam Sadvadutam Parijana Sahita Krishna Chaitanya Devam Shri Radha Krishna Padam Sahagana Lavita Shri Vishakam Bhutam Cha. So we're going to start. We're going to start at the end. Because if you're planning to go somewhere, what's the first thing to do?
Decide where you're going.
Decide where you're going. Generally, people do that. Some people just go. Especially young people tend to do that. Put on a backpack and go somewhere. But generally speaking, there has to be a destination. It would be appropriate now to tell you one story about Prabhupada, but that's for another day, son. That's for Monday. I'll save that. Anyway, one needs to know where one's going. So therefore, we're going to start with where we're going. Just like before we got the ticket. And first of all, you had to tell me where I was going. And I decide whether or not I wanted to go there.
And then you did.
So that's the first thing. Where are we going and do we want to go there? The goal of our practice is Prem Bhakti. Now people talk about the goal of their religious system, and generally people don't understand what the goal of their system is. What kind of goals do people usually give for their religion?
Liberation.
Liberation, usually. Salvation, right? And it doesn't matter whether you're, you know, a Hindu or a Christian or whatever. Generally, they're talking about salvation or liberation, isn't it? Even though in all the scriptures it talks about love. You don't hear very many Christians saying, if you go to Jesus, you'll get love for God. They usually say, if you go to Jesus, you'll get saved. Most Hindus, they talk about mukti, do they? They usually talk about prema. And the Muslims and the Jews usually just talk about going to heaven. I guess some Hindus do that too. And some Christians do that too. You go to heaven and have a barbecue with your family. Seriously, that's what you think. No kidding. That's one of the things that convinced me to stay in the Hare Krishna movement. The day after I joined, I went to the airport to distribute Prabhupada's books, and I'd meet all kinds of people. So some of them were saying, well, we know we're saved. We're going to heaven. I said, well, that's nice. What do you plan on doing there? And they were really proud. Not that I'm not proud, but anyway, they were really proud. And they said, we're going to do the same things there that we're doing here. Literally, when you watch TV. No. And if you look at your second page of your chart, and sorry, I guess it's like a fifth world country and it has staples in Germany, so you kind of like fold the corners. Even in India, they have staples. You should be able to find staples. The girl's only got one page. Discrimination. The boys get two pages, the girls get one page. It's so typical for the material world, you know. The girls can only get halfway there. They can only get a Kanishka, only the boys can get the frame. And the next life, you take birth as a man, the next life you can get the frame. I mean, I've had the boys tell me that. I wish I were joking. I really wish I were joking. Unfortunately. Anyway, be that as it may. Does everyone now have prema? At least a paper about prema. And so what happens in Prema Bhakti? As someone was asking me yesterday, how we can develop attachment for Krishna without having seen him. And of course, we see him to some extent even before full attachment. But when one has full love for Krishna, what happens is that one fully experiences Krishna, not just seeing. Prabhupada would often say, why do you only want to see God? Why don't you also want to hear God? You know, that famous song by George Harrison, you know, my Lord, I really want to see you. So when the devotee is in prema, he experiences the Lord through all of his senses. First through sight, then through smell, then through hearing, then through touch, then through taste, and then the Lord's quality, specifically of generosity and compassion. And what happens in each of these stages is that the devotee feels when they're seeing the Lord that all of their senses are eyes, that their whole body has become like a big eye. And when they're smelling the Lord, they feel like their whole body has become like a big nose. They're just overwhelmed with the Lord's fragrance. So I'd like to read a little bit to you that this is the beginning of the goal of life. This isn't the end. Krishna consciousness is not static, it's ecstatic. I'm sorry, it's a bad joke. It's dynamic. It's not that you reach a stage of perfection and then you're just kind of, you know, blissed out and, you know, forever frozen like a figure in a wax museum. So this is the beginning of prema bhakti. This is the beginning of love of God. And it goes on through various stages and various activities and relationships and ever-increasing pastimes. And when I was giving the lecture, as I do almost every year, to these Southern Baptist ministers who are in graduate school, I was talking about how the Lord's qualities are unlimited, but they're always expanding. One of the ministers says, how can that be? How can something that's already unlimited be ever expanding? So they're unlimited in time also, and therefore they can be always expanding. So the activities of the person who attains prema bhakti is always increasing. But please don't think that this description is it. This is the beginning of the destination. Just like, you know, you arrive here at Simachalam and you see all your old friends, but then the festival keeps going. It's not that the arrival is the end. So this is the arrival. And now I lost my place. Okay. The Lord first reveals his beauty to the eyes of the utterly astonished devotee. The sweetness of his beauty makes all the senses and the mind become like eyes to see the Lord. The resulting symptoms of ecstatic love, such as tears, shivering, and being stunned, cause the devotee to swoon in ecstasy. To revive him, the Lord next reveals his fragrance to the nostrils of his devotee, and all the devotee's senses and mind take on the quality of the nose to smell. As a devotee starts to swoon a second time, the Lord says, O my devotee, I am fully under your control. Please don't be disturbed. Just realize me to your full satisfaction. The Lord thus discloses his pleasing voice to the ear of his devotee, and as before, all the senses become like ears to hear. As his devotee swoons a third time, the Lord mercifully gives the touch of his lotus feet, hands, or chest, revealing his delicate softness according to the different relationships of the devotees. To those in the mood of his servant, he touches his lotus feet to their heads. To those in the mood of friendship, he grasps their hands in his. For those in the mood of parental affection, he gives the touch of his hands by wiping away their tears. For those in conjugal mood, he awards his tender softness by embracing them to his heart with his long arms. Again, the devotee senses all take on the sense of touch to feel his softness. At the start of the fourth swoon, the Lord restores him by giving him his fifth sweetness, the taste of the nectar of his lips. But this he reveals only to those who at this time are in the mood of conjugal love and desires this, but not to others. You might say, well, that's not very fair. But actually, we are all experiencing the taste of the Lord's lips. How is that? The holy names, yes. And also Chaitanya Mahaprabhu says specifically through How are we all tasting? Prasanna. And Chaitanya Mahaprabhu says, and he's eating some prasanna that's been offered to Jagannath, and he said, all these ingredients are all ordinary ingredients. So what is this extraordinary taste? He said, because Krishna has eaten it, so the touch of his lips and his saliva has touched this food, and therefore his incomparable taste. So those of us who are accustomed to always eating prasadam, we may not necessarily understand how wonderful it is if we're a little dull. But at one time in Puerto Rico, I was doing a program at a university. One of the devotees made some cookies, and I was in the kitchen cooking the devotee main meal while she was making the cookies. So I got to see what she was doing, and it was very simple. I mean, it was really, really simple cookie recipe. As simple as you can do it is you have cookies. And we took it with us to the university, and the students were eating them. And the students, the professors, to a person, they all said, what are in these cookies? Can we get the recipe? Everybody said that. Never had food like this before. It's a secret ingredient. So that is the Lord's taste. The devotee's senses all take on the sense of taste, and he faints for a fifth time. This blissful swoon is so deep, the Lord can revive him only by bestowing his quality of generosity. This quality of generosity is the state where all the Lord's qualities, beauty, fragrance, sound, touch, and taste, forcefully manifest all at once to the devotee's various senses. Then, prema, love of God, understanding the mind of the Lord, increases to the utmost, and with it the keen hankering of the devotee. Prema becomes like a powerful moon in the heart of the devotee, presiding over the ocean of bliss and creating hundreds of waves. It causes an almost destructive friction in the devotee's heart among the competing tastes. At the same time as the presiding deity in the mind, the moon of prema expands its power and allows the devotee to relish all the different tastes at the same time without conflict. One should not think that due to the lack of single-mindedness, the devotee will be unable to relish the fullness of all the various tastes. Rather, the senses attaining the extraordinary, inconceivable, wonderfully amazing capacity to do the functions of all the other senses, even more fully savor the sweetness of the Lord's beauty, pleasant voice, and other qualities. So in other words, each sense is able to do the function of all of the senses simultaneously. There's a psychological condition, maybe Chita Shakti can be. I know the name, where people can do things like see music. Do you remember what that's called? Certain people have this ability that their senses are to some degree interchangeable, and they all like it. None of them want to be cured of it. They don't want to take some drug so they become normal again. So Krishna, of course, can do that. We know that Krishna's senses can each perform any of the functions of the other senses. So the devotee also, in love for the Lord, can take in all of the Lord's different qualities with all of their senses simultaneously. Mundane logic is useless in these inconceivable matters. This is from the Mahabharata. Don't try to understand these matters that are inconceivable with mundane logic, as being beyond material nature is the meaning of inconceivable. Seeing the devotee yearning to relish the beauty and other sweet qualities of the Lord all at once, but helpless, like a bird trying to catch every raindrop at once in his beak. Imagine a bird outside when it's raining, running around from one raindrop to another, trying to drink all of them at once. The Lord considers, oh, why am I keeping so many wonderful qualities to myself? To let the devotee partake of them all. So first it was generosity, where the Lord gives all of his qualities at one time. And now, the Lord manifests his seventh sweetness, compassion, the superintendent of all of the Lord's shaktis. I don't know if any of you went to my lecture on Krishna's qualities that I gave in Soho. I think it was last summer. when Prabhupada talks about from Rupa Goswami's Bhakti Vaishnavita Sindhu, Miniature Devotion, about Krishna's quality of compassion, one of his, I mean, all of Krishna's qualities are wonderful, one of my favorite qualities. So, who personifies Krishna's quality of compassion?
Chaitanya?
Yes, Chaitanya. Why Chaitanya? Because he's in the mood of Radharani. So the epitome, the personification of the Lord's compassion is Radharani. And when the Lord takes on the mood of Radharani, then he is in the mood of utmost compassion, which is very fortunate for people like me. One needs compassion. Without compassion, if there was a great debate in Christendom hundreds of years ago, what's higher, justice or mercy? But if all we were functioning under were justice, we'd be in pretty sad shape. I remember one time a devotee asked, you know, it doesn't seem like the world is fair. Things should be fair. And my response to that is, you don't want things to be fair. Now, we have no idea how much suffering we deserve if things were fair. You know, we want mercy. Which, by the way, means we have to give mercy. But that's a different discussion. To let the devotee partake of them all, the Lord manifests his seventh sweetness of compassion, the superintendent of all the Lord's shaktis, or energies. She reigns as a supreme empress in the middle of a lotus, on whose eight surrounding petals are the eight shaktis, Vimala, Utkarshini, Jnana, Kriya, Yoga, Pravi, Satya, and Ishini. And if I were doing this in five or eight seminars, I would get into these details, but I'm sorry. So there's some things that I'm just going to mention but not explain. This kindness or favor manifests itself in the lotus eyes of the Lord. Well, that's how the shakti of compassion is coming from the Lord's lotus eyes. To his devotees in the mood of servant, it is known as Kripa Shakti. To his other devotees as Vatsalya or sometimes Karuna. So mercy or friendship, compassion. When it appears in relation to the devotees in conjugal moon, it is known as Chitta Vidra Vini Akarshini Shakti, that melts the heart of Krishna and attracts him. So Krishna means all attractive. Prahlad Maharaj, she says, I'm attracted to the Lord like little pieces of iron are attracted to a magnet. Yeah, like Maharaj was saying yesterday, you know, the wife wanting the husband to return, the bird wanting the mother bird to come back, the calf wanting its mother's udder. So this strong attraction. We all feel in this world, all of us have felt this kind of strong attachment. I don't see or hear Ramachandra right now, but if he can't see his mother for a little while, you know, his father.
Mama.
It's the strong, because she represents everything to him. She represents food, literally. She represents warmth, security, comfort, safety. So wherever he is, he always has to make sure his mother is around. And all of us have mothers. So we all experience that as children, and those of us as adults, if we've fallen in love, well, we've also experienced this sense of being drawn like a magnet to somebody, this irresistible force. And so Krishna is the ultimate magnet. Janaka janani daita tanai prabhu guru pati tuhu sarvamani. Krishna is really the mother, the father, the lover, the son, the husband, the guru, everything, sarvamani, he's everything. And whatever magnetic attraction we feel in this world, it doesn't last. And none of us as adults are as magnetically attracted to our mothers as we were when we were 1 year old. And we can forget about her for a whole month, practically. Those of you who are mothers, don't be offended. We also don't think about our children the way we thought about them when they were infants, right? When the child's first born, the mother is always thinking, where's my baby? Where's my baby? She's waking up at night, you know, is he breathing? But now you're not wondering if your kid's breathing, right? You're not thinking every few minutes, is Sandipan Krishna breathing? So the attraction lessens. The intensity lessens after some time. And we have a little child. Wherever you go, you're always thinking, where's my child? Is he okay? Is he okay? Is the person who's taking care of him taking good care of him? But, you know, when your kid's 25, you're really not thinking like that anymore. And when we're 25, or 35, or 45, or however old we are, we're not thinking, you know, where's my mommy? Where's my mommy? Is she here? Did she walk out of the room? And the same with romantic attraction. You know, the first year and a half, 2 years, one's always thinking, oh, my beloved. And then after a while, you know, it's not like that. Oh, I'm glad he went out of town for a while, but I got a break. It diminishes. And with Krishna, it doesn't diminish. And with Krishna, that intense attraction is constantly and constantly and constantly increasing. That intoxicating. One person was saying to me yesterday, oh, I just chanted Hare Krishna on beads for the first time. He said, this should be a controlled substance. I was thinking, two things I was thinking, that we're always talking about being intoxicated in love of God. And secondly, it is a controlled substance. It is a controlled substance. The nectar of the holy name is only available. You have to have a license. That's actually what we're going to talk about mostly this evening and tomorrow morning. How does one get the license? What are the requirements? You don't have to be a certain age, you know, you have to have a certain kind of ID to have access to this controlled substance, which makes you mad. I should warn you that you are going to become mad. If you want to remain sane and sober and materially respectable in this world, you should leave now, because it's not your house. Okay? What we're describing here is divine madness. So materialistic people are also crazy. They're working for all things that are going to be lost. Is that crazy or what? It's like little Ramachandra. He can hardly speak. He knows a few words, but he has a hard time saying sentences. So many of you are in universities. You're working so hard to get your education. And then, you know, 80 years from now, you're going to be going bad, bad, gag, gag, goo, goo all over again. It's all gone. And you're going to have to sit in school all over again and take your exams all over again. And you're working so hard to get money. You know, you're going to have to earn it all over again. All these things, you know. Get your teeth all over again and the whole business. Why are you working for these? It's crazy. It's like, you know, building sandcastles. You're working, make it really perfect. And so you're seeing some of these beautiful sand sculptures, but they don't make them right on the shore of the ocean. Even then, they don't last for very long. But still, they don't build them right where the waves are going to hit them like that. And that's what we're doing. Our life is just like that. So that's madness. However much people may seem very sober and respectable and hardworking and driven, serious. It's crazy. It doesn't even give you any happiness. What's the happiness? I have money. Does it make you happy? Does it fill you with unlimited ecstasy? 24 hours a day, 7 days a week? Does anyone know of any material pleasure that fills you with ecstasy 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, with ever-increasing intensity and sweetness and variety? Anyone want to volunteer any material pleasure that has that ability? Funny, isn't it? It gets really old, too. Just think of your favorite food. Think back on your favorite food. Okay. So we're going to serve that for breakfast. And then we're going to also serve it for lunch. And we're going to also serve it for dinner. And then we're going to serve it tomorrow for breakfast. We're going to serve it tomorrow for lunch. And we're going to serve it tomorrow for dinner. In fact, every meal for the rest of the time you're here, we're going to serve your favorite food. What's going to happen after about a month of this? I don't want to see this again. We have to have this bhogatyaga. We have to have a break from things. Otherwise, we don't enjoy it anymore. You do something constantly. After a while, you get tired of it. So we're going for pleasure that becomes... Also, you have to suffer in order to enjoy it. Can you enjoy eating without hunger? Is that possible? If you have no appetite. If you just ate a big meal and someone gives you your favorite food when you're stuffed, can you enjoy it? Doesn't the food always taste better at the beginning of the meal when you're hungry? But hunger is suffering. Can you enjoy sleeping if you're not tired? That's like a punishment, you know. Go to your room, go to bed. Why do people do things to increase their lust? And you know, lust, how can you enjoy sensual romantic pleasures? You can't. But that's suffering. Lust, hunger, exhaustion, those are suffering conditions. So our pleasures in this world are all predicated on suffering. In fact, they don't exist without suffering. You have to have the suffering first in order for the pleasure to even have any meaning. They're very temporary. They're not fully satisfying except for maybe a few minutes. I mean, how long is a good meal fully satisfying for? 10 hours? 2 days? I don't think so. And they decrease. And that's what we're working for. So that's crazy. I mean, that's really, really crazy. So therefore, our choice isn't really between sanity and madness. It's between what kind of madness. But just like to us who are on the spiritual path, people who are spending all of their time and energy for these temporary, insignificant things that are mixed up with pain seem to us like total loonies. We ought to go see Chidi Shakti for some therapy. So we will also, as we progress in spiritual life, we are also going to appear to be very strange and peculiar and mad to them. Most sane persons appear to the world as somewhat mad. At least inscrutable. Materialistic people cannot understand those who are going towards prema bhakti. It doesn't make any sense to them at all. So this bhakti, it is so wonderful that it attracts Krishna, the all-attractive. It attracts Krishna and melts his heart. Thus it is known by many names according to the different moods. By this mercy of this compassionate Shakti, the Lord's all-pervading free will influences the heart of the devotee and causes great astonishment, even in realized souls who are fully self-satisfied. This compassionate energy invites a quality called affection for his devotees to rule as emperor over all the Lord's auspicious spiritual qualities. So when the Lord feels compassion for the devotee, this love and compassion the Lord feels for his devotee is his topmost quality. To completely relish the beauty and other qualities revealed by the Lord, the enlivened devotee savors them over and over again. Most astonishingly, their sweetness increases more and more, and the devotee ascends to higher and higher peaks of experiences, then continually realizing the unheard of sweetness of the Lord's bhakti-vatsala, the love for his devotees. The devotee's heart begins to melt. The Lord, showing his kind nature, says, "O my devotee, many births you have given up spouse, house, and wealth to attain me. For the sake of my service, you endured untold miseries such as cold, wind, hunger, thirst, and pain. Maintaining your life by begging, you tolerated countless insults and abuses from other people. In return for all your sacrifice, I'm unable to give you anything. I've simply become your debtor. Rulership over the whole earth, lordship over the heavens, and mystic powers are unsuitable for you. How can I give them to you? No, no, grass and straw, the delight of cows, I cannot give to a man. Although I'm unconquerable, the Lord says, today I've certainly been conquered by you. Now I'm taking shelter of your excellent character and gentle qualities. Hearing these words of the Lord's as ornaments on his ears, the devotee says, Oh my Lord, my master, you glanced upon me while I was being bitten by swarms of crocodiles, the endless miseries amidst the terrifying current of birth and death. Thus mercy arose as the sun and melted your butter-like heart. You destroyed ignorance and bliss. Destroying my suffering, you purified me by constant hearing, chanting, and remembering your name and glories. Throughout the association of your own dear devotees, you made me understand how to render service unto you. You make me feel shame by saying from your lotus mouth that you have become my debtor. Now what do I do? My offenses number 5, 7, or maybe 800,000 millions. I can definitely say they must be more than trillions. Would I be arrogant to ask you to pardon them all? But beginning devotees, we generally say, Krishna, don't let me suffer for anything I've done wrong. Just give me a nice life. But here the devotee in love is saying just the opposite. Just let all the reactions to my past sins remain, intense and long-standing, suffered and yet to be suffered. How can somebody pray like that? But are they like masochistic? Why are they saying, I deserve to suffer for trillions of offenses, and I'm not going to ask you to forgive me, I'm going to have you let me suffer? How can they say that?
Invoke compassion.
To invoke compassion, Krishna's already being compassionate.
To remember Krishna more, wonderful.
Oh, maybe from the point of view of someone who's not praying a bhakti, yes.
To allow Krishna to have his will.
To allow Krishna to have his will. Is somebody in this state experiencing suffering? No. And we're just describing the unlimited varieties of ecstasies this devotee is experiencing. So you think even if something is happening to their body and mind, they're going to experience their suffering? No, not at all. They're probably not even going to be aware of it. But they're happy to let the Lord's will be there, and they don't think of themselves as worthy of being excused. Our part of our disease in this life is that we think that we should never have to suffer for anything we've done wrong. We should think we should just, you know, either everybody should tolerate our offenses because we're such nice people with good intentions, that someone brought up the other day. That even when we do something wrong, we always have good intentions. Yes. All of you do, I'm sure. You know, or we think we should just be able to settle things easily. Oh, I'm very sorry, and then it just fixed, and we can go on being our same offensive, arrogant self. So a devotee in humility is not thinking like that, thinking, let me suffer. If you really want, this is just, I'm not going to get into this in depth. If you really want a key to how to deal with suffering, pray like this to Krishna. Don't be afraid. Say to Krishna, whatever suffering that I'm going through is for some reason, for something I deserve, it's your will. I am willing to go on suffering like this, if that is your will, forever. Make an experiment sometime. You have to mean that. I'm not going to tell you what will happen, you'll see. But you have to mean that. You can't say that some manipulative thing. Well, if I say that, you know, like you go to your parents when you're a little kid. And say you're sorry, they say, I'm sorry, and okay, now they won't punish you. So you can't play games with Krishna. But that's our general response to suffering is, Krishna, can't you fix it? You know, the little kids come to me as a teacher. Hey, so-and-so hit me. Tell them to stop. I say, do you listen to me when I tell you what to do? Why do you think they're going to listen to me? We always want to fix everybody else. So the other part of the prayer, Krishna, if it's your will and your desire that I suffer in this way, I am willing to suffer this forever. And please rectify my heart. Whatever the suffering is meant to rectify in my heart, please reveal to me how you want me to be rectified. That's a little hint. It's a big jewel I just gave all of you, although it may not look like that. Just one day before, I was rudely comparing your dark limbs to the fresh monsoon cloud, the blue lotus, and the sapphire, your beautiful face to the moon, and the tenderness of your feet to newly sprouted leaves. Now, seeing your real beauty, I realized that by my poor intelligence, I was clearly offending you. I was trying to compare half a useless mustard seed to a golden mountain, a chickpea to a touchstone, a jackal to a lion, and a mosquito to Garuda. So I'm going to stop there. It's a little book. You can read it in an hour or two. And you can peruse the details on your own. So now that we've looked at the goal, and that's the beginning of the goal. It isn't the whole goal. That's, you know, your plane's landed. So you've just been driven to the farm and you just see the farm for the first time and you meet the devotees. The festival hasn't even started yet, so that's what we just described. I'm not going to, in these classes, describe the whole festival. I'd have to have another class slot for that. But hopefully this is at least of interest. So now I'm going to go through very briefly the various stages, and then I'm going to deal with the very beginning. I'm going to spend a little bit more time in the very beginning, which should answer the question that someone had yesterday, day before yesterday, about what is causeless mercy. So if you look at your chart, hopefully everybody now has two pages, and we can just briefly go through what are the steps. Okay, this is our itinerary. So first of all, we should mention that these it's not exactly like an itinerary. You know, when I'm on the plane from North Carolina to Detroit, I'm only going between North Carolina and Detroit. Whereas one can be partially in one stage and partially in another. Just like all of us here, I'm sure we remember that stage where we were not quite children and not quite adolescents. You all remember that stage? A little closer for all of you than for me. But, you know, when you picked up your fire truck or your dolls and you tried to play with them and they were only interesting for a minute or two and you put them down again and you tried to play with them again and you just couldn't quite do it. You know, vroom, vroom. That doesn't make it anymore, you know. You know what's happening to me? So, and your body isn't quite a kid's body and your body isn't quite an adult's body, the boys go, you know. You don't know when you're sort of halfway in the middle. And in some ways you act like an adult, in some ways you act like a kid. So these stages also, there's some overlapping. And we'll find that people can be at one stage in one area and another stage in another area. That would just be very clear. Also, how long one takes in these stages is to a large degree up to each of us. Again, so it's a little different from an itinerary. On an itinerary, it will say, you know, this flight is an hour and a half. This flight is 5 hours, then you have a 3-hour layover in this airport. So we can't say like that, that this stage takes this amount of time and this stage takes this amount of time. That's up to you. So you can be in a stage for 5 minutes or you can be in a stage for a very long time. I mean, I know some people connected with our movement who stay in some of these stages for 30 years. You know, the eternal Bhaktas type. So I've seen people for 30 years at Adrashrada, you know, it's Hare Krishna. So one can stay at some of these stages for lifetimes. Also. So the first stage is beginning faith. And that faith can come spontaneously by oneself or it can come from somebody else's preaching and inspiration. And this is basically a little faith. There must be a God. Maybe there's spiritual life. Maybe there's something beyond just my senses and mind. A little openness. Aravinda Suparu said that when he traveled with Kamal Krishnamurti and Vishnu Jinan Swami, they would go to a park and they would, you know, play the harmonium, chant, and distribute prasadam. And then Kamal Krishnamurti would walk around the audience and just say to people, nice music, huh? Like the food? And if they liked the music and the food, he would stay and talk to them about Krishna. And if they said, eh, that's all right, then he would go on to somebody else. So that's Adrashrada. Now, this music is really nice. This food is good. That's Adrashrada. Is there a God? What am I anyway? So at this point, one time when I spoke on this, somebody got so angry at me, they said she didn't come to my class for a month afterwards. So this part is a little hard on the false ego, and I'm really sorry, and I don't mean to offend any of you. If it's hard on your false ego, figure it applies to everyone in the room but you, okay? Just most people would do that anyway. But look at consciousness. So at the platform of Adrashrada, our material attachments are absolute, and our spiritual interest is just a spark. One thing I'll get to this evening is, at this stage, generally, we think that we're very advanced. That's one of the symptoms. We usually think that we're a great saintly person, and we're going to become self-realized, you know, at least within the next year, probably 24 hours. So, but actually, our self-consciousness is absolutely, we just have a little spark. Then the next is sadhusanga, associating with devotees. So one just, and again, you see people who stay at this stage forever. they just come to the Sunday feast and they kind of hang around and they do some service and they just sort of stay there. So that's, this is two kinds of sadhus or saintly persons. One is people who are like-minded, so people who are at a similar stage to you, and then also very exalted saintly persons from whom you get some instruction and guidance. So at this stage, material attachments are not absolute anymore, but they're pervading. And spiritual consciousness has gone from a spark to a little trace. And you see that at neither of these stages are we really getting any diminishing of karma. One's still suffering from one's previous karma, from offenses and from other obstacles. And I'm going to discuss these obstacles more this afternoon. I'm not going to discuss that this morning. So then the next is Vajanakriya. Vajanakriya, during this time, one takes initiation. One takes vows. I'm going to chant 16 rounds every day. No meat, fish, or eggs. No intoxication. No illicit sex. No gambling. One starts in the process. One gets up early every morning, attends Mangal Arati, reads the scriptures every day. One starts going through a regulated process. And there's two parts of Vajanakriya. One is unsteady and one is steady. And this is what I'm going to focus on this afternoon. So in the beginning, one, by definition, is going to be unsteady. And there are various symptoms of being unsteady. But one is taking up some process. And in the unsteady stage, one is taking it up more or less ritualistically. You're doing it because you've associated with the same person who says this is what you should do. You know, okay, well, I should chant 16 rounds, I should do this. There is going to be some spiritual pleasure from those things. But it's not that you would just naturally do that on your own. You know, if left to your own devices, you sleep till 7 in the morning. But because the sadhu says, get up at 3:30, you get up at 3:30. So that's Vajanakriya. On your own, maybe you chant 2 rounds one day, and 5 rounds the next day, and 10 rounds the next day. But the sadhu says you chant at least 16 rounds every day, so you do that. You know, on your own, today you worship the deity, and tomorrow you just give him some water, and the next day you do a whole puja. But the sadhu says, no, you do at least this minimum regulated service every day, so you do. So that's Vajanakriya. Now, once one starts in Vajanakriya, one gets relief from a lot of material distress. And one's life also becomes auspicious. Now here we see that although the material attachments are still in full force, that there is some partial, the trace of spiritual consciousness has become a little bit greater, has become partial. And relief from past karma is almost complete. Now, of course, people, this stage generally takes a long time. It's not unusual for a person to be an unsteady Vajanakriya for a very, very, very long time. Because it's in this stage that you're dealing with what's listed here as the next stage, Anarjanavritti. What are you doing in this stage of unsteady devotional practices? And we'll define what we mean unsteady this afternoon. You're clearing out all the garbage. I was speaking to the guy the other day. I was mentioning how when we chant, one thing that happens is we see the dirt. When we come to Krishna consciousness, we don't think we have any dirt. We think we're just basically nice people. No, well, we'll say, well, yeah, I have some problems. Yeah, sure, everybody has some problems. But we don't really believe that we have any serious problems. And if someone convinces us of it, we get very depressed because we're very proud and we just can't deal with the fact that we have a serious problem. And then either we stay depressed or we push it aside and say, well, you know, well, they're just jealous or they just have some issue or, you know, they need to go to a psychiatrist or whatever. I need to find somebody else. I'm incompatible with them because they see my faults, you know, whatever it might be. So what happens in Vajanakriya is one starts to see one's false self. One barely sees the real self, but you start to see the false self. And so this is a cleaning work that's going on. And Prabhupada says that going through these first stages is a hard struggle with determination. There will be little whiffs of ecstasy. There will be. Now, most of them are shadow or reflected ecstasy. It's not anywhere close to the full ecstasy of praying. There will be feelings of spiritual happiness, undoubtedly. But primarily it's going to be a hard struggle with determination. Because cleaning out an old, musty garage that hasn't been cleaned for 200,000 million years is mostly work. There's some satisfaction from seeing it cleaned out, you know, but it's mostly work. So please be prepared. Please don't think that spiritual life is just some, you know, downhill roller coaster ride. It gets to that point. Prabhupada says, after nishtha, then everything comes automatically one after another. And when people quit, they usually quit during this cleaning process. There's too much garbage here, they say. It's too hard. It's going to take me too long. I'm tired. Let me close the door to my garage and forget the garbage is here and go back to my suffering life in the sand. So in this stage, meditation is momentary with a tinge of material topics when you try to meditate on Krishna. So anarjana vritti, again, is going on during the stage, the cleaning out of the anarjas. At first, we clean out the gross anarjas. You give up illicit sex, intoxicating, eating, gambling, and gradually you start to see deeper and deeper and more subtle levels of pride and envy and lust and greed. It's kind of amazing. Oh, whoa, I didn't know I had that. And as you go deeper and deeper, even the things you think are good qualities are manifested. You see that they're actually not. It's quite interesting. It's quite interesting. I remember Bhakti Chuswami saying in one class, he says, yeah, the more you advance in Krishna consciousness, the more you feel that you're not advanced. That's kind of that. But it's only in that mood of humility that you can feel happy. You can't feel much happiness when you're proud. I'll give you a simple example of that. Just like we had this birthday cake yesterday, a little surprise birthday cake. And where's Mira? Did she leave? And there you are. So did you feel that you deserved that? Were you happy? Suppose you had expected it. Suppose you had come here thinking, they're all going to know it's my birthday, and I expect a really big party. You know, everybody in the planet is saying that they're probably each going to give me a gift worth at least 50 pounds. Would you have felt happy with the party yesterday? No, you would have felt disappointed. So, I mean, I experienced that when I had a surprise party for my 45th birthday at the temple where I live. I hadn't expected it at all, and I was so happy. But as soon as we think we deserve something, then whatever we get isn't enough. So just imagine if we were totally, absolutely 100% humble, if we think we deserved nothing, then everything we got would fill us with joy. So what makes the cleaning process painful is our own pride. We're making it painful. If you're humble, it's an ecstatic process. Even the cleaning is ecstatic. Okay, the next stage is nistha, steadiness. And there's two kinds of steadiness, steadiness in devotion and steadiness in qualities. We're primarily interested in the steadiness in devotion. And the steadiness involves three things, being steady in your body, steady in your mind, and steady in your words. And generally, first people are steady in their body, then steady in their words, and then steady in their mind. So steady in the body means every day you chant 16 rounds. Every day you go to Mangalarti, unless you're sick or on an airplane. Don't do Mangalarti on an airplane. I have to go every day. I once read about some, I don't remember if they were Jews or Muslims. Just like we say the Gayatri at the sunrise and noon and sunset. So the Orthodox Jews, they have to say prayers also at the sundays. And the strict Muslims, of course, they pray five times a day at certain times. I don't remember if it was Jews or Muslims. But they were on a plane where the sun was kept rising. steadiness in body doesn't mean you have to be like that. The sun keeps rising, so I'll say my Gayatri 5,000 times. And then steadiness in word, you just talk about Krishna, you're not talking about nonsense, you know, who's the latest movie star, what are they doing, and what are the present affairs of the present political leaders, and it's not, this is the, we call this the garbage heap for the crows. You know, we're interested in political reform, we're interested in social reform, we're interested in spiritual entertainment, but we're not interested in just discussing, you know, former President Clinton's various liaisons or the, you know, how which movie star got divorced or something like that. Who cares? And so one should just be talking about Krishna. And then finally one's mind should always be absorbed in Krishna. Now at the stage of nishtha, the mind is absorbed in Krishna by force. The mind wanders up. Krishna talks about this in the sixth chapter of Bhagavad Gita. From wherever the mind wanders due to its flickering and unsteady nature, one should certainly withdraw it and fix it again on the self. But that's done deliberately. And at the stage of nista, and up to and including the stage of nista, the mind wanders without the devotee understanding how that happened. So I'd say that unless any of you here have taken birth already past the stage of nista, we all have experience of this. Just like the first day, my Govardhan didn't get put on the altar. And so I asked the pujari, I said, you know, could you make sure you put him on the altar? And he said, well, next time just put him with the other Shula so I'll see him. Because unless I see him, I forget about him. And then we were joking and said, even when we see him, we forget about him. And even when we were looking at the Singhadev, and we're thinking about something else, we're thinking, is she going to be quiet in time for us to take her son? I wonder how my socks are doing. What do I have to do at 2 o'clock this afternoon? You know, so we don't know how that happened. You know, we'll be chanting, we're looking at the deity, we're reading the scripture, and all of a sudden we're thinking about, and we can be thinking about anything. We can be thinking about some chewing gum commercial we heard when we were 5 years old. Actually, one devotee said that he was swimming in the Ganga, and the current was very intense. He started to drown, and he started thinking about a chewing gum commercial. And he's drowning. Hare Krishna. And we don't even know how it happened. Why am I thinking about this? Just 1 minute ago, I was thinking about how beautiful Krishna's eyes are, and I'm thinking about his butter-stealing pastimes, and all of a sudden I'm thinking about, you know, stupid thing. So at the stage of nista, that happens. The mind just wanders. You don't know how it wanders, and you go there. So in the stage of nista, material attachments are still prominent, but spiritual attachments become pervasive. So it starts out, our material attachments are all the way up here, and our spiritual attachments are traced. At nista, they're just like this. And at that time, the reactions to past activities is complete, eradicated. Reactions to offensive is pervasively eradicated. And reactions to the negative attachments we have that come from the process itself, that, oh, I'm such a good devotee, everybody should respect me, that is completely destroyed. Then at ruchi. So ruchi is taste. You know, if we're not at ruchi yet and we think that Krishna consciousness is fun, then you ain't seen nothing yet. In ruchi, one is experiencing real, deep pleasure from Krishna consciousness. Meditation is long-lasting. Other topics are absent. And just like at nista, material attachments are here and spiritual attachments are here. At ruchi, it becomes like this. When spirit finally... Finally, your hard struggle with determination is over. And your spiritual attachments are above your material attachments. At this point, any attachment to prestige and etc. from being a religious, righteous person is absolutely finished. And there's two types of ruchi. One can get some taste when everything is materially nice. You know, the kirtan singer sings on tune. The prasadam was cooked nicely by our resident cook. The deity is dressed very nicely. And the other kind of ruchi, you enjoy it even if that isn't there. Even if the person is going, Namamishna, you still enjoy your time. And even if the cook forgot to put salt in the cooking, you still enjoy the prasadam. You enjoy even Urmila's prasadam. So that's the different level of ruchi. So then there's a shakti. Now at a shakti, there's two changes that happen. In ruchi, you have a taste for the service. In a shakti, your taste is for Krishna himself. You become drawn not just from hearing about Krishna, chanting about Krishna, and serving Krishna, you become drawn to Krishna. And in the shakti, your mind naturally wanders to spiritual topics and you don't know how it happened. Somebody said, you know, yeah, did you hear that France didn't want to join the European Union? And all of a sudden you're thinking about, yeah, and Krishna's calling the gopis, and Radharani says, I don't know if I really want to come because you're with that other gopi. How do I think about that? So that's a show. You're at work, you're doing the accounting at work, you're writing a computer program, you know, you're treating crazy people in the hospital, whatever you do for your work, you're changing diapers. And all of a sudden, you're just thinking, remember when you sort of looked in Krishna's mouth and saw the universe? How did I think about that? And Shakti, one's material attachments now are just a trace. And one's spiritual attachments are full. At this point, one's karmic reactions are absolutely gone. At the stage of the Shakti, one's original spiritual body can, it may be the Shakti or Bhava, can start to manifest in seed form. And one starts to realize, oh, I'm a coward warrior. I'm Krishna's cow. I'm a gopi. And starts to have some indication of what one is. Of course, Krishna may reveal that to some extent in an earlier stage. He's independent. Krishna's not bound by this itinerary. He can show whatever he likes. But generally. Then after that is Rata or Bhava. Bhava means emotion. And if this is like Asakti is the very beginning, so then Bhava is the Asakti is the bud and Bhava is the flower and Prema is the fruit. So Bhava is rarely achieved. And here in meditation one actually sees the Lord, and there's two types of Bhava, one with awe and reverence and one with spontaneous love, and I'm not going to discuss that today. At this point, one's material identification is just a shadow. Oh, I'm an American, I'm a Britisher, I'm an Indian. Yeah, yeah, somebody told me that once. I have some vague memory of that. So it becomes almost like a dream. Sarvapada, Nirmuktan, Tatpartain, and Nirmala, Rishikesha, Rishikesha, Sevanam, Bhakti, Vichita. All the upadis, all the designations. I'm a man, I'm a woman, I'm Indian, I'm American, I'm French, I'm stupid, I'm smart, I'm artistic, I'm clumsy. They become like shadows. And who our real self becomes manifest. Oh, I am really this. I am really this. This is my real position. And at this point, the reactions to our offenses are almost completely eradicated. And then finally, at prema, one feels unlimited, ever-increasing happiness. It is the only thing that really attracts Krishna. And one's meditation is direct association with Krishna. One isn't just seeing Krishna in meditation. Finally, at this point, one's consciousness of self is absent. One never thinks about oneself. One just only thinks about Krishna. That doesn't mean you don't have a self-identity. It's just there's no absorption in it whatsoever. And when you attain Krishna's association, as explained at the stage of prema, then there's no more reactions for offensive. The last thing I want to explain briefly, I'm sorry it's 9 o'clock. But I'm trying to fit like 8 hours into two here, so I hope I can go another 5 minutes. Is how does this whole process start? The process starts through causeless mercy. Someone asked me the other day, what is causeless mercy? How does one begin the process of bhakti? You know, how does one get this beginning faith in the first place? Why do some people have it and some people don't? Now, one thing that happens to many of us when we first get interested in Krishna consciousness is it's so wonderful that you just want to tell everybody about it, and you're convinced that everybody that you tell will be just as enthusiastic as you are, and it doesn't happen, and it's kind of confusing. Oh, read this Bhagavad Gita, chant Hare Krishna. And they go, why? Oh, yeah, I looked at it. It's kind of okay. Or why is it Tamal Krishna Maharaj would walk around and some people would say, yeah, the food and the music are great, and other people go, yeah. So, the answer is that bhakti is independent. Devotion for Krishna is independent. It's not dependent on anything material. It's not dependent on how pious you are, how righteous you are. Of course, yes, I know there's that verse in the 7th chapter that those who are free from sins in past life and in this life take the devotional service with determination. But not necessarily. Even a very sinful, degraded person can become interested in bhakti and have faith in bhakti. It happens. But people become devotees of Krishna while in prison, you know, where they're suffering for having committed crimes. Magrari the hunter became a devotee. It happens. It's not dependent on that. Yes, it's more helpful if you're pious, definitely. It's just like, could we have this class outside in the rain? Sure. It's more helpful to be inside here where there's light and there's, you know, you have nice cushions to sit on. But it's not necessary. And in fact, by taking up bhakti, you become inclined to lead a pious life. It's not dependent on knowledge. By taking a bhakti, you get knowledge. But having scriptural knowledge, it's not required. Even detachment isn't required. You don't have to start off being detached. If you take up a life of hatha yoga or jnana yoga or karma yoga, and you make one mistake, you're going to suffer for it. That's why we don't advise people to take up jnana yoga or kundalini yoga in this age. I have a very good devotee friend who was obviously very advanced in such yoga from a previous life, and the symptoms of advanced kundalini yoga just arose spontaneously in this person. Someone was born in movement. And this devotee was telling me that people who try to awaken their kundalini when their body's not clean, when all their, those of you familiar with Ayurveda, when like the nadis and the sushumna are not clean, that they end up becoming sick and even sometimes crazy. They end up having some mental and physical diseases. Their body's not capable of handling that energy. So if you take up these other yogic processes, although they are meant to be assistants to bhakti, karma yoga, jnana yoga, jnana yoga, they're all meant to assist bhakti. And in other ages, people did use them to assist bhakti. That if there's any little fault, you'll actually suffer. And they're dependent on so many things. You have to have so many prerequisites in order to practice them. Bhakti's not like that. If you start chanting Hare Krishna, even if you're a filthy mess, the process of bhakti itself will cleanse you. You won't suffer by taking up bhakti in a degraded or impure state. It doesn't require anything. So bhakti is coming only from bhakti. Okay. Next point is, why does the Lord give bhakti to some people and not others? I mean, if we say the Lord's giving it out of his causeless mercy, we don't see that everybody gets it equally. So is he partial? Well, no, we know Krishna's not partial. There's a lot of sections of the Bhagavatam that deal specifically with the fact that the Lord is neutral. He's inclined towards someone who already becomes his devotee. But even that is a symptom of neutrality. It's just reciprocation. It's not really partiality. You know, obviously, I'm going to deal differently with people who are nice to me than people who are nasty to me. It doesn't mean I'm unfair. That's just reasonable. So if you love Krishna and you treat him nicely, well, then naturally, he's going to show himself more to you than he is to somebody who criticizes him. I mean, that's not partiality. But that talks about someone who's already developed bhakti. That Krishna is reciprocating with them in a different way. It still doesn't explain how he gets it in the first place. So if Krishna's just neutral, if he doesn't interfere with us, he just awards us what we desire, where does it come from? Well, we know that bhakti comes from, not from Krishna, bhakti comes from where? The devotees. Bhakti comes from the devotees of Krishna. And particularly devotees who are in what mood? The Madhyama Bhaktas, the middle Bhaktas. The devotees who are in the mood of the Uttama, the highest transcendence, they also adopt this mood of neutrality that Krishna has. The Uttama Bhaktas, they see everybody's already perfectly where they should be. There's no reason to interfere in anything. Everybody's getting what they want, everybody's getting what they deserve, everybody's part of the plan of the Lord, everyone's ultimately a spiritual being. There's no need to interfere. There's no need to do everything. Everything's already perfect. Which is the way Krishna sees things also. So someone in that mood isn't interested in preaching and giving out bhakti. And most of the residents of the spiritual world are in that mood, otherwise they'd come here. But one gets in the mood of a Madhyama Bhakta. What do we mean getting in the mood of a Madhyama Bhakta? Just like if I'm teaching a child how to read. So when I read, I just read. But you can't just read to a five-year-old child. You have to know things like ka-at, cat, sat, sat, the cat, sat. And I don't read like that. I don't sound out my words. You know, if you're teaching mathematics, you also, you know, at a certain point, hopefully, you sort of jump a lot of the processes. You sort of just come to the answer. But when you're teaching mathematics, you have to verbalize all the different steps you'd have to go through. In other words, you have to come down to a lower platform in order to teach. You have to behave as if you're on a lower platform. That doesn't mean that you've lost your ability to read just because you're teaching five-year-olds. But you're adapting the mood of a five-year-old, in a sense, in order to teach a five-year-old. So in order to preach, the highly elevated souls who see everything with detachment and neutrality adopt the mood of a middle devotee who makes four distinctions. They see God, to whom they give love, people who are already devotees with whom they're friends, people who are demoniac and atheistic who they just avoid. Not with hatred or condemnation or self-righteousness, but basically out of humility, I can't do anything to help this person. And then they see people who are innocent, people who are not cruel and nasty and evil and, you know, kill God, but they're not devotees. So the innocent people, they give bhakti. How do they give bhakti? It's explained in Nectar Devotion, they can give bhakti by glancing, by just good wishes. Boy, I'd like it if this person would develop bhakti. You know, by going out, just like we're going to have this Harinam Sankirtan in a few days, by going out and singing Krishna's names in public, even at the cost of one being personally criticized. It's not so easy to go out in public, you know, and with a shaved head and a saffron dhoti. A little easier on the sari, I think. Especially if you're Indian-bodied. It's a little harder to go on the sari when you have blue eyes and white skin. People think you're pretty weird. You know, and why are we doing that? We're doing that out of compassion, to give bhakti. So when the devotee is thinking, my dear Lord, please give this person bhakti, we know that Krishna's topmost quality is he's inclined to the devotee. So when the devotee says, Krishna, please give this person bhakti, then Krishna, who is not out of partiality, but just out of normal reciprocation, inclined to the devotee, does what the devotee wants, and because the devotee wants to give bhakti, therefore Krishna gives that person bhakti. But where does that devotee's desire to give bhakti come from? From their own bhakti. So bhakti is giving bhakti. And you can say it's due to the receptivity of the person. But still, bhakti is only coming from bhakti. It's not coming from some other source. So that's what you mean by causeless mercy. What is the cause for Krishna's mercy? It's the desire of the devotee. But that desire is not a material desire. It's just coming from love. And where do they decide to give bhakti? Generally, they decide to give bhakti to people who are innocent. But not always. Sometimes devotees give bhakti to people who are most offensive. The most offensive person. Can you give me an example? Jagai Mata. Right, Lord Nityananda was in the mood of a devotee. They try to kill him. You know, we don't usually try to help out people who try to kill us. Hopefully no one of us has had someone try to kill us, but if you could imagine if somebody was trying to kill you, you generally wouldn't say, please, Lord, give this person love of God. Probably say, Lord, make sure they suffer in hell for her. You know, sometimes that's another talk. So sometimes the devotee will give mercy to the people who are the most degraded. So that's also why it's explained causeless. You can't make some absolute rule that devotees are only wanting to give bhakti to innocent persons. It just isn't the sense. So that is how this process begins. So now we've gone terribly over time and you're all very hungry. I mean, in Chalpati they have Bhagavatam class on Sunday until 10 in the morning. But I don't think most of us want to be that austere. Remember when I went there, class started at 8, and they said, you know, we go till 10. I said, what do the devotees do for prasadam? They said, oh, they're all prepared. I said, well, they have snacks in their pockets. I'm sure since you don't all have snacks in your pockets, you can take breakfast. And I'm going to concentrate this afternoon. I actually planned for a bunch of interactive stuff, but I was trying to do too much in one time, so I didn't get to it. I'm going to be concentrating on a little piece of this afternoon. And actually what you could do that would be helpful is before you come this afternoon, since we're also trying to do a concentrated thing, is you could write down a description of a hypothetical devotee. Please don't make it somebody you actually know that we all know, because that won't work out very well. Pick a hypothetical devotee and describe them, and we're going to have other people guess what stages they're at. Okay, so just using this chart and these descriptions, just a paragraph, you know, 4 or 5 sentences, if you could come prepared with that. Okay, that would be very helpful. Do you understand what I mean by that? No? Do you want me, if any of you do, you can leave, and if any of you don't, just stay for a minute, and I'll just read you a sample. So like someone who gets up at 2 o'clock every morning for the last 15 years, chants all his rounds before Mangalarti, spends Japa time reading Prabhupada's books and taking notes, works a full-time job to support his family, does deity worship 2 days a week, gives out Prabhupada's books every Saturday, tries to think about the mantra when he chants, but his mind often wanders. Sometimes he purposely lets his mind wanders. Likes to attend devotional festivals, but sometimes just ends up sleeping when the kirtan's going on. Usually likes to bring some aspect of Krishna conscious philosophy into conversations. Sometimes ends up criticizing devotees, and sometimes talks about useless things, but is trying to figure out when he does that so he can stop. Sometimes he pulls his mind back to Krishna, and sometimes he lets his mind wander onto material things. He often thinks his chanting and his spiritual practices are kind of dry and boring, and he also thinks of himself as a very serious, fixed-up, and advanced devotee. So that's a sample of a kind of description, if you could come up with some descriptions. And again, please don't pick one particular person to describe them, especially if everybody else would figure out who you're talking about. And although it could be a conglomeration of different people, and if you could bring that with you, then we can do an exercise on that. Thank you very much. All glories to Srila Prabhupada.